Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, are you willing to donate your genes to science? Many have already done so and it doesn't need to wait until you're dead. If you've ever thought of having your genome, your personal genetic information decoded, some pros and cons, the latest on genes that increase a woman's risk of breast cancer, and a study from Melbourne which has found that longer consultations by general practitioners have significantly declined. GPs appear to be focusing on shorter, more profitable sessions with their patients. Certainly one complaint you hear is that people don't feel they get enough time with their doctor. And on the other side, many GPs feel frustrated that the pressures of a full waiting room limits what they'd like to offer. And as we age and accumulate more medical problems which will never go away, especially if they're complicated by mental health issues, it's hard to give the care that's needed in a quick in and out. A group at La Trobe University have tracked the trends in length of consultations, as reflected by Medicare rebates and claims. Michael Taylor is one of the authors, and he took me through the eye-glazing details of Medicare consultation definitions.
There are four basic consultations provided by GPs under Medicare, levels A through to D. There's many differences between them, but the major one is time. Level A is very short. Level B is one that lasts less than 20 minutes. Level C is between 20 and 40 minutes. And a level D consultation is one that's 40 minutes or longer. Level Bs are the most common GP consultation provided.
This is the fabled 6-minute consultation, because that's where a GP maximises his or her income.
Yeah, it's what's known as the 6-minute one, although, like I said, under the service rules, with anything lasting less than 20, there were just over 86 million level Bs provided by GPs in 2012. The longer consultations that I'm talking about today, the level C and D consultations, they're less frequent than that, but still quite important. In total, there were almost 13 million of those during 2012.
It's probably fair to assume that the demand for longer consultations has gone up because more people need complicated care. The trouble is that the supply of these consultations by Australian general practitioners has fallen. Michael Taylor again.
The major findings were that when it came to level C consultations, there was a 20% drop in how many the average GP was providing, but the same proportion of GPs were prepared to do those consultations, and that was a consistent 95% or more of them.
So you've made an extrapolation, you've assumed that they're willing to do them because they still do them, they just do 20% fewer.
Yes, and with level D consultations, we saw a 25% drop. But in addition to that, we found that of those that were doing that service previously, so prior to around about 2006, 1 in 7 GPs had just stopped doing them completely.
During this time, you've seen increased corporatisation of general practice, so more and more GPs going into these large 24-hour medical centres or extended-hour medical centres, which are bulk billing. And my understanding of the economics is that you make the most money, and the corporation running it makes the most money with standard consultations. Is there any difference between bulk billing GPs and non-bulk billing GPs in the time they give their patients according to the data that you have?
Not according to the data I have, because I can only see what Medicare pays.
So this is at a time when GPs have had access to what are called enhanced payments for people who've got chronic disease they're not going to get better from, and they require multidisciplinary care and more love and attention, in a sense, from a wider group of professionals. So the GP might have felt, well, look, the patient doesn't actually need my time, they need these other people's time, and therefore a standard consultation will do.
Quite possible that's one of the reasons that we're seeing this additional drop. The major issue is what we term audit anxiety amongst GPs.
So this is the fear of abusing Medicare, that somebody's going to come in and say, you're doing all these long consultations, you can't possibly do all these, you must be defrauding the system.
There is always that fear. Another possibility is that because of that fear, a level D quality service actually then gets billed at the lower rate, just in case.
We could cry into our coffee over this one for a long time, Michael Taylor. The question is there any evidence that quality of care is lousier if you're just going to be going through standard consultations?
To a certain extent, it's going to depend on what it is that people are being treated for. And when it comes to quality chronic disease management, longer consultations have been shown to provide higher quality care and quality of diabetes care being improved.
So what's the answer?
Looking at the payment model is probably the first step.
So increase the rebate to doctors for a longer consultation.
Well, I think we do need to look at equalising those rebates. When it comes to the ordered anxiety, we've already seen some simplification of the service rules. I don't know that we have yet solved that one entirely. Probably still a long way to go.
Michael Taylor is in La Trobe University's School of Public Health. And this is the Health Report here on RN with me, Norman Swan. Still to come, would you give your genes to science? And what, if any, value is there in decoding your own genome, your set of genes, given the current state of knowledge? One condition where more and more is being discovered about the genes involved is breast cancer. Several years ago, researchers discovered two very potent genes, BRCA1 and 2, but others are now known. The question is, how much do these genes matter, and should women find out if they have them? David Hunter of Harvard School of Public Health in Boston is an international authority on breast cancer genetics.
We've made a lot of progress in the last 4 or 5 years. Collaborative efforts involving scientists in the US, the UK, Australia, has been that we've found about 70 points in the genome that are associated with small, modest risks of breast cancer.
And do they work together or separately?
They all seem to work completely separately. They basically add together. So out of these 70 variants, if a woman carries a high proportion of those risk variants, then she'll be at higher risk of breast cancer than if she has the good fortune to inherit a small proportion of those variants. And it gives you about a threefold variation in risk between women in the top 5% of that distribution versus the bottom 5%.
And by the top, you mean women who have more of these changes on their genes than in their genome than not?
Exactly.
And none of them confer the magnitude of risk of the first couple of genes that were found, the BRCA1 and BRCA2.
Exactly. So I said sort of threefold between top and bottom, and BRCA1 and BRCA2 at young age, that's more like 20-fold or 30-fold. But the difference is that the mutations in BRCA1, BRCA2, fortunately, are relatively rare in the population. In most European ancestry populations, less than 1 in 500 women carry a mutation in BRCA1 or BRCA2. These are variants that a very much higher proportion of people carry. Often they're found in 20 or 30% of people, but the risks are much, much lower per variant.
But they affect a much wider group of people.
They do, and as time goes by, we're almost certain to discover more of these, and so those risks will increase a little bit.
And what proportion of breast cancer could be attributed to the genes that you know about?
The real answer is that we still think we can only explain maybe 20 or 30% of the familial tendency to breast cancer. So we know there's a lot more of these risk variants in the genome yet to be found.
So what are these genes doing? And do they tell you anything about breast cancer itself?
Great question. It's still early days, but the revelation has been that by and large, these genes haven't been in genes that were thought to be associated with breast cancer. It's really opened up a whole new realm of biology. We used to think that only about 2% of the genome that gives rise to the coding of proteins was where all the action was. People used to derisively refer to the rest of the genome as junk DNA. But we discovered that most of the variants we were finding were, in fact, outside the protein coding regions. And so now there's a lot of attention and a lot of new data that suggests that these are the critical parts of the genome that regulate the protein coding part of the genome, and it's that regulation that might be more important, whether a gene switched on or off at a certain time of development, that might be more important than whether the gene is mutated or not.
What do you think of 23andMe and projects like it, people offering cheap genome testing?
You know, I'm very skeptical of the value of that. The question is, well, what do you do with that information? There'll be a small subset of actionable information that might relate much more to how we differ in our response to certain common pharmaceutical drugs, for instance, that will be worth knowing. And then there'll be the rest of it, which will be much more uncharted territory. Having said that, we're already at the point where, theoretically, if you did a whole genome sequence of a woman early in her life, you would know about a threefold difference in risk between the top and bottom of that normal distribution. So you do have to ask, and people are asking, would you recommend earlier mammography if you are up the top end of that spectrum? Would you recommend more frequent mammography? The diseases for which there are preventive means would be the diseases that you would probably want to focus on first. Diseases for which you really haven't got anything to offer are diseases which this information will be less directly clinically actionable. And the problem with the companies like 23andMe, et cetera, is that they don't tend to differentiate that information. It's just information. You know, there are published examples of the fact that if you compare the different commercial services, they don't always agree on these risks. So what's a consumer to do? But they're a clear signal that we really have to get our act together, if you will, to try and generate the information so people can more reliably interpret this information because it's coming.
When you say there are problems, is it problems in the interpretation in these labs or problems with errors? Because somebody was saying to me, I think last week, you only need to make an error one in every 100,000 parts of the code, and in 3 billion lines of code, you've made an awful lot of errors.
The technical error is not the problem. The real problem is that we are still at the very, very earliest days of interpreting this information. We're finding all sorts of fascinating things. So if you were to sequence my genome, I haven't had it done yet, you would find in my genome, probably in your genome too, a couple of variants that might be in a database that says that we're at risk of some ghastly disease. But we've managed to get into middle life without that ghastly disease. And if this is an early onset disease, clearly that information wasn't very relevant. So there is potential here to really frighten people in a big way once we move beyond a small number of genes for which we have highly predictive information and into this amorphous world. Probably what is happening is that in some settings, there's a variant that is associated with a disease, but maybe you've got another gene that's kind of backup copy or can duplicate the activity. So maybe that has to be mutated before you get the disease. But we still don't have that information, and that's why we can look in someone's genome and find something that has been reported as causative for an early onset nasty disease in people who actually don't have that and appear to have escaped the disease.
So buyer beware at the moment.
Absolutely. And then there's always the environment. Lifestyle and environment definitely play a role and can modulate this genetic information in a way that means that the genetic information is not predictive. And obviously that gives us room, if we have enough data, for hope that we might be able to sort of offer things that people can do to reduce their risk.
So what would it take for you to have your genome tested?
Good question. It would probably take it to get to $100. So I could write a check. This is the US. It wouldn't appear necessarily in my medical record, where I could still, even though we have certain laws now that are helpful, I could still be potentially discriminated against. Not such a problem in Australia and other enlightened countries, I hope.
Oh, it is a problem in Australia. It's a big problem in Australia. There's no legislation to protect you.
But you have essentially a health insurance system that means that you can't be denied insurance on the basis of pre-existing conditions.
But you could be denied life insurance.
And that'll probably always be the case, I think. So good reasons for me to sort of have it on a thumb drive and not on my doctor's computer. And to be serious, the point is if I was going on one of a small handful of drugs where this information is actionable, then I've got the choice. I can get the specific test, which will cost somebody a few $100, or maybe I can get my whole genome for $100. And at that point, I'll be getting it done. And I imagine a lot of us will be too.
David Hunter is Professor of Epidemiology and Nutrition at Harvard School of Public Health, which is also where Giovanni Parmigiani works. He's a statistician and has been concerned about the same issues as David Hunter, namely the current lack of meaningful information from your genome. Professor Parmigiani has been trying to calculate what value there really is in having your personal genome decoded now and into the future.
We're trying to quantify the amount of information that one can extract from a person's genome. Person genomes is a vast amount of data. Translating that into actionable health information is a huge challenge. And one of the studies that we recently carried out tries to look at the scenario in which scientists become omniscient and can decode all of that data and translate it all into information.
This is some mythical time in the future.
This is some mythical time in the future, which I'm not even claiming that we can ever reach that point, and maybe I'll explain you why in a minute. But if we were to reach that point, how valuable would it be from the standpoint of health to know the genome of a healthy individual?
Let's capture that now. Why do you think we might never get to that point?
We might never get to that point because there is enough variation in the genome that we will very likely observe many variants in people that are unique to them. or that are maybe not unique but are shared by a small enough number of people that we will have trouble studying these variants. So it's a question mark. It's an open question.
Okay, but you're assuming, hypothetically, we get there.
Let's say we do. Then the question is how useful that information will be. And we've taken the angle that information is useful if it makes you change a behavior, if it makes your doctor change a behavior, or if it makes a medical recommendation that is different from what you would have done without that information. And we've taken a rough approach at modeling that. If the risk of disease given your gene, your information from the genome is high enough, then that would trigger a health behavior that's different. And we estimate that for maybe 20 or 25 of the most common diseases, a percent of about 20 to up to 60 or 70% of the individuals who will ultimately develop the disease will be forewarned loudly enough to change their behavior ahead of time if they had known their genome, which is a quite significant proportion.
And by the way, you did this by studying in twins.
We did this by studying twins, and the reason is that twins have the identical genome. And so they're a wonderful little experimental system that we can use on humans, right? And we can see how often two people who have the same identical genome also have the same identical fate when it comes to health outcomes in the long term.
And that's where you get to this figure of between 20 and 60%.
Yes, that's how we get those figures. We did what is called a meta-analysis, which is basically gathering everything we can from the literature and putting it into a unifying framework and analyzing it all together.
So splitting the difference, assuming that we know everything there is to know, about half the time you'll find something that's handy.
Well, let me put it this way. The percent that I was quoting you before is, if you get a disease, how often would your genome warn you that you did get that? Now, in terms of what proportion of the population would be forewarned, that's a smaller percentage because the variation that drives the disease is not as common. So maybe for common cancers, 5 to 10% of the people would be forewarned.
And I interrupted you, we were going to talk about colorectal or bowel cancer.
Yes, that is a type of cancer that is among the most preventable. We have screening approaches based on colonoscopy, for example, that are very effective, but are not currently scalable so that they can be applied to the population in general. There are some risks involved, not to mention the cost. And so we need to use them cautiously. But if we say, for example, that a risk beyond 10% were to justify having frequent colonoscopies, then eventually, using information in the human genome, we should be able to identify 40% of the cases ahead of time. And those cases would be highly preventable cases. And this information would become relevant for 5% of the population. So we're talking about a very large number of people who could potentially be impacted after we become omniscient, as we hope we will be.
But it's still not 100%. It's a long way from 100% of every single person.
So you're exactly right. So there's two types of uncertainties involved here. Our uncertainty in understanding what the genome is telling us, and two, the uncertainty of two twins that even though they have the identical genome, they will not have the same fate. And that uncertainty we will never resolve. It depends on everything that is random about our lives, everything about the environment, and a number of facts that even if you know exactly what your genome means at birth, it will make it impossible to predict exactly what happens to you down the line.
So you'll get to the point where doing your genome, you can't trust a negative. In other words, if you don't show up a problem, there's no way you've got any mental security here.
You're absolutely right. The negatives are practically useless. Information from the genome is unlikely to be very helpful if it tells you that you are in the not at risk group. For example, someone generally has a risk of colorectal cancer in their neighborhood of 6 or 7%. And we figure that even knowing everything there is to know about the genome, we could cut that down to maybe 3 or 4%, which is not a fundamentally different risk in terms of...
So an absolute change of 3%, which is really not very much. The people who propose widespread genome testing say, look, it's not so much diagnosing your destiny in terms of a definite disease, but it will diagnose your risk factors and that you could change your behavior.
This is a very interesting point. I think that the twin studies take that into consideration in our overall estimates. We don't discount that possibility when we make our calculations.
So that's in an ideal world where you know everything there is to know about the genome, should we ever get there.
Yes.
Where are we now? We're a long way from that.
We are a very long way from there. The genome is teaching us very, very important lessons about what causes diseases and how we can go about trying to cure or prevent diseases. And little by little, we'll make progress. Our goal was to size up what is the ultimate limit to which that progress can take us. That limit, I personally feel, is a wonderful place. even though the glass is not full, it would be a very different world from where we are now.
So you think those are not too bad odds if you could
No,
do...
I don't.
So where are we now? I mean, what would be the predictive capacity now?
That varies very much from disease to disease, and it depends on the extent to which the genes that are really responsible for a particular health outcome have been fully identified, or to what extent they have been identified. Within cancer, which is my field, there's a very big difference, for example, between colorectal cancer, where there are major genes that are responsible for inherited susceptibility that have been already identified and characterized, as compared to, for example, prostate cancer, where most of the inheritability, which is very high also, is still yet to be characterized. So, for example, just to wrap up the thought, if I may, if knowing your genome today is a lot more useful for someone at high risk of colorectal cancer than for someone at high risk of prostate cancer.
And even colorectal cancer, we still don't know the majority of genes that are involved.
We still have a gap to fill. That's right. I personally like the idea of knowing my genes and knowing what they predict about my life, even if I didn't have any specific health outcomes in mind. There are two camps here. Those that think that, you know, unless there's an actionable item in terms of health, it's not useful information. And others who want to know because they're curious. It's a little bit, you know, you're reading a book and it's a book that you like, and you know that at some point the light is going to go off. Do you want to know when the light is going to go off or not? Maybe. I'm in the camp that prefers to know, and I would still enjoy the book, but that's very personal.
So have you had it done?
No, I haven't. No. But I would.
Once the price comes down.
That's right.
Giovanni Parmigiani is Professor of Biostatistics at Harvard School of Public Health in Boston. Well, even if you're not interested in knowing your own genome, would you put it out there for the benefit of others? That's the intent of the Personal Genome Project, founded by George Church. George Church is Professor of Genetics at Harvard Medical School.
The Personal Genome Project is the only project in the world that I know of where the world gets open access to information about genomes, environments, and traits in human beings. Everything else is either proprietary or is closed or only addresses a tiny component.
In other words, companies are looking to patent what they find.
Right. I mean, companies can still patent what they find in our database. We're not anti-company, but we are open access so that everybody has an equal chance, because you don't want to patent things that are present in nature. You have to add value to them. So we provide a way that people can see the consequences of certain environments and gene combinations, and they can get an insight into precision medicine as it emerges.
Tell me how it works.
What was revolutionary about this particular project, in addition to providing open access, in order to provide open access, we realized that most medical research, especially genetic medical research, was making potentially disingenuous or false promises about privacy, because if you're going to be sharing the data, there's a chance that the data will get out of whatever vault you're sharing it in and then get re-identified. So that combination of escape and re-identification means that you shouldn't be promising privacy to research subjects. I mean, you could still promise it to the public, but the research subjects should be selected as individuals who understand the risks and feel that the benefits outweigh the risks and are willing to be identified. I mean, we don't necessarily have to identify them, but they are willing. They've signed up for that and they know what they're getting into. And we provide an entrance exam that they have to get 100% on, and it's intended to work for a broad population.
So who participates?
Anybody who's over 21. It's now international, so that basically anybody in the world can participate. They have to get educated a little bit up front. It's only 20 questions, so it's not hard to get that. But it basically, instead of giving you a consent form that you just sign without reading, it walks you through it and makes sure you understand all the nuances of the risks and benefits.
So these are people who, for entirely altruistic reasons, are willing to have their genome analyzed and then published.
Not just their genome published, but their medical traits, their medical records, standardized questionnaires, behavioral and cognitive, just a whole vast and growing number of human things that make them individuals.
So if I took part, what would you be asking me to divulge to you?
Everything that is of medical significance and many things that are not medical but make you unique. Things like the facial morphology is of interest to not only medical interests, but for identification and jurisprudence and forensics.
And how many people have taken part so far?
There are now a number of international groups that are just, well, I don't know the numbers. We have about 2,000 participants that have gotten 100% of the exam and have put some of their traits online.
And had their genome?
So we have about 200 full high-quality genome sequences available online, and we have about 500 that are genotyped in some sense or another. An increasing number of people are coming to us that already have their genome information from some other source, and we do quality control on that and put it online.
And do you give them their genome results?
So for the ones that don't already have it, we'd give them the genome results, and we give the whole world their genome results. And we provide interpretation tools as well, so it's not just a bunch of random letters.
So a medical researcher in Italy who's interested in the relationship between facial tics and heart disease could go into your database and see whether or not there are genetic correlations.
Right. Yes. In principle, you could make connections between environment and traits without even touching the genetics, but the most powerful one would be when you use all three together, and it is international.
And does anybody need permission to use it?
No, it is like Wikipedia. It's intended to be for anyone who thinks they can contribute. It's not for us to judge whether some person in India who doesn't have all the credentials might actually be a genius with a computer and really can make a huge contribution. So rather than us judging that, we just let everybody contribute.
Who funds the genotyping?
It's privately funded. We've had all kinds of generous government funding on technology development, but the coalescing of the data and making it public and all the social, ethical, legal is done either on a volunteer basis or our private donors.
And has anything come out of it yet that you're proud of?
Our social things have come out. We've enabled studies. I mean, like Wikipedia, it's not about us. It's about all the uses of it. It's enabled journalists to communicate on it. It's enabled competitions where third parties have posed questions. Can you tell what, say, the lipid levels of this person is just looking at their genome? And because it's all open, or what we can do is we can keep some of it closed until the competition is over, but we enable that because we know eventually it will be open. And so there's a few competitions.
So you're crowdsourcing solutions.
And they're using us as well, yeah.
George Church is Professor of Genetics at Harvard Medical School and has a remarkable laboratory working on synthetic biology, where he tries to understand the complexity of life by literally creating new organisms, sometimes made of new chemicals. Certainly no stranger to controversy. He's also developed cheaper, faster and more accurate technologies for decoding DNA and building new DNA molecules. We'll have the link to the Personal Genome Project on our website. That's the Health Report via abc.net.au/radionational, abc.net.au/radionational. I'm Norman Swan, and you can hear The Health Report three times each week. On Radio National, you can hear it on Mondays at 5:30 in the afternoon, on Tuesday mornings at 5:30, I'm sure you get up early, and if you want to hear it on Saturday mornings, you can go to ABC News Radio, and it's on at 11:30 Eastern Time, so 8:30 in WA and whatever the time is in your part of Australia. But you can listen to us anytime you like by downloading a podcast from the Health Report's website via RN. Also, there's transcripts there going back many years and links to useful added information. That's it for this week. I'll see you next time. But now it's time to find out what's on Drive with Jonathan Green. Good afternoon, Jonathan.
Norman, hello. Now, are you surprised at this news today that we're tapping phones in Indonesia? Did that come as a shock?
I'm absolutely floored by it. Floored by it. Are they tapping ours? Yes.
I imagine so. But there's a weird paradox in this story that we all know this happens, and yet the revelation is astounding. I thought we might crawl around in that as an idea, why this surprises us, because it's
And we've got to feign thing. Horror. We have to feign horror.
It's best that we do. I think we should compose our faces to give just that impression. Mm. So that's coming up in our first hour this evening. Second hour tonight, we go to Chogham in the aftermath there. Issues there around both human rights record in Sri Lanka, of course, and also around the reluctance of both the Canadians and the Australians to sign up to certain measures around climate change. And speaking of climate change, we'll also go to Warsaw, where the UN Climate Change Conference is in trail as we speak, and we'll get a report back from there. Speaking of climate, what might bring, I wonder, emus to the main street of Longreach? So that, now, Norman, you may laugh.
I can't wait. I'll be sitting glued.
It's an unusual occurrence, and we will find out just why that might have happened on RN Drive coming up after the news at 6. News time now, 6 o'clock.
Now at the RN website, a special live set from our Melbourne studios. WA's Mamakin is an all-round entertainer. She can break your heart and make you laugh all in the same song. From foot-stomping hollers to heart-wrenching ballads. But in the moment that I touched you, join us for this powerful performance with Mamakin. You can stream this live set from the RN website.